Welcome to the IDC podcast. The IDC promotes independent research on antitrust and competition law and policy issues, being also the point of contact between all those who have a special interest in the area, both in Latin America and globally.
IDC, Instituto de Derecho a la Competencia in Spanish. I am Nicolás Levin. I am based in Chile, and I am collaborating with the IDC in this session today. I am very honored to have the possibility to moderate this panel today with the presentation and comment of the book Competition Overdose by their authors, Professor Ariel Serraji. He is a Slaughter and May Professor in Competition Law at the University of Oxford and Director of the Oxford Center for Competition Law and Policy. Also the co-author, Professor Maurice Stuckey, who is the Douglas A. Blaze Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Tennessee. And with Annelien Stratmans, who will be commented on the book, and she is a well-experienced international lawyer based in Brussels with a strong background in antitrust, and she has experience in private practice and as an in-house counsel, and she has developed a lot of interest in big data and other very important issues right now. She's also vice chair of the Woman at Competition and director of CX Ventures. And as another background of her, she's a certified sommelier. So maybe you will find something interesting regarding the questions we will have on a poll later. Now, I want to leave you with Pablo Trevisan. Pablo Trevisan is the crazy guy behind the idea of the IDC. And I want Pablo to explain a little what's the IDC and to give us some background on that. For those who don't know Pablo, he is a former member of the Competition Commission in Argentina. He's a lawyer in Argentina, and he has an LLM in London School of Economics, and he's a candidate for a PhD in law by the University of Buenos Aires. Pablo, please, if you can. Thank you, Nicolas.
I am not the only crazy guy behind the IDC. It's it's already actually a very good team. I would say it's a dream team. So not only me. Talking about the IDC, the main objectives, I mean, the idea is to all the new people that are connecting to know what exactly is the IDC, why I admit those who are being connected now. The objective of the IDC is mainly to promote independent investigations on issues related with competition law and policy. The idea is also to be a sort of a point of contact between academics, professionals, judges, authorities, enforcers, legislators, and to disseminate ideas and promote investigations and discussions on issues related with competition law and policy. One of the main issues really with the IDC is also that we don't want to have a physical venue. It's mainly a virtual place where we want to connect, and actually the pandemic has really helped us on that regard. Also related with the IDC, we already have an international consultative or advisory board that is called, actually the members of that board are Richard Wish, Ian Forrester, Philip Marson, Simon Holmes, Larry Sorokin, Barry Hawk, Eleanor Fox, Makis Kominos, Mark Patterson. Some of them are connected today. So for example, Barry, very nice to see you around. And as I said, it's not, the idea is to have the IDC open to everybody. This is not a place for just one or two or three person. It's actually, the objective is to be open to everybody. We are having next activities. As I said, we already have chapters in Argentina, Mexico, Colombia, Chile. We are starting with the activities in Mexico on the 7th of October with an event that will be moderated by Carlos Mena. former enforcer in Mexico. And we are also having the same week an activity with Tommaso Valetti. We will keep you posted, so sign in if you want, but I mean, we will definitely keep you posted on through LinkedIn or through all the other media. So before we start, we have a very short poll that we wanted to share with all of you. So we're gonna launch a poll. It's only four questions. We'll give you some time to answer the questions. There we have, so four questions. One is the consumer welfare standard, I mean, the consumer welfare standard shall be, and we have three options: retained, refined, replaced. The second question is competition always good? Yes, no, don't know. This was also inspired in one of the keynote speakers, on one article of Maristaki, actually, I think it was 2013. Competition benefit consumers always, true, false. What's your favorite meat? Beef, pork, horse, plant-based, not sure. Not sure, there's a mistake there. We already have eight answers. I think we can have more. We are 34 people connected right now, so please don't be shy. I mean, my main interest is on the last question. If you want to go answer that directly, that would be very important for us. So we give you 30 seconds more to think. We have 16 answers. I'm receiving more. Okay, we have 19 answers. Okay. We will leave it there. And here we are, we have the results. The majority, 60% of the audience think that consumer welfare standard, as it is understood in the US mainly, should be refined. 50% think that competition is always good, while 50% think otherwise. Competition benefit consumers, always. It's false for a majority. That's interesting also. And the favorite meat with 75%, it's meat, beef. Some people are also veggie here, so 15%, I'm not sure, 5%. So said that, Nicolas, I think there are the results and you can see it by yourselves. Nicolas, that's all I had to say.
Thanks, Paolo. And now going on the presentation of the book by the authors, I would like to address a few words. This is a very interesting book where the authors find different elements where competition can be classified for them as toxic and to backfire sometimes regarding the elements it tries to protect or try to benefit. And in that sense, they try to give when those situations arise with very good examples. And then they give the reasons on why this can happen for having a final chapters on the solutions that they propose. So without any further delay, I will give the word to Professor Esrahi and Professor Staki.
Thank you very much, Nicolas, and thank you very much, Pablo. Let me share the screen, and we'll begin with our presentation. And at the end of this presentation, I think it will be interesting to see whether people still believe that competition is always good, but even more important, whether you still believe that beef is your favorite meat. I think this will be interesting. Okay, so hopefully you can all see the slide. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Super. So in this book, Maurice and I, basically, as the title suggests, we look at whether competition indeed is always good, but more importantly, we try to see whether we as a society might have overprescribed the idea of competition. And this is really the key message of this book. And one of the questions that we are often confronted with is, so how exactly did we come up with the book? I mean, what is it behind the book? And this is really an interesting story, because I think it's a story that many of you might actually feel that you experienced it in some way or another. Because when you look around you, in Western societies, what we have is an elevation of the idea of competition. So we're often told that if there is a problem, if there is anything that we want to improve, the solution will often come from rivalry. And it reached a level that almost competition has almost elevated itself to a level of religion. So the belief in competition is so significant that if there is any problem that you see in education, in any form of policy, one of the key solutions that we outsource to our problems will be the competitive process. And the promise is that if you increase competition, then we will all benefit. Now, no doubt, competition is often the best solution. I mean, we're definitely not challenging this. But what really happens is that more and more, when you look around you, instead of the promise of you feeling better, everyone improving, you actually feel that you're in somewhat of a rat race. So we increase the pressure of competition, and yet many of us are not getting the benefits that were promised. In fact, most of us probably now work longer hours. Many of us are being paid less. There are issues with the rights that we get when we work. And yet the idea is that in a competitive process, we should have benefited. And this really brings us to the argument that what we need is a much more nuanced view of the role of competition. In many ways, competition is like medicine. And when you go to the doctor, when you're prescribed the medicine, you are told how much to take of it. And you know that if you overtake the medicine, it will harm you. And we argue that competition, the ideal of competition, is very much the same. Competition is extremely beneficial. Many times it is much more efficient than the government intervention. And yet the warning labels on this instrument completely disappeared. What happened, because of populism, because of the way that policies are being managed, the warning labels that economists would argue and would put again and again on the competition remedy just somehow were removed, and we were left with an ideal of competition that is limitless. So now maybe, Maurice, if you can give us some sort of an introduction to how we set up the book, when competition is toxic, and who should we blame when it is.
Okay, so as Ariel pointed out, that, you know, we've been teaching antitrust now for over a decade to our student. And what we started, you know, there's almost this faith that we have in competition. And when is it that increasing competition can actually make us worse off? And our challenge was not just to come up with a few anecdotes, but actually to look at what are some of the central assumptions underlying competition, and what happens then when you relax some of those assumptions. So what we were able to do was we were able to come up with four categories. When once you relax the assumptions, you can then have toxic competition. And it takes us really through this interesting world where we begin with hockey players and look at the college admissions process in the United States and the recent scandals that have come to light. And it's really not surprising, because in our first scenario, we find what converts competition from being a race to the top to a race to the bottom. So when does competition become the pejorative arms race? Then after looking at that, we look at competition and safety, quality, human labor, the environment. And that takes us then through the pressure cooker. And Ariel will touch on that. And then the third is that we always have this view that, you know, underlying competition is that it works really well when everyone is a rational, self-interested profit maximizer with full information. But when does competition go from competition helping boundedly rational consumers with imperfect willpower to competition to better exploit? And to what extent can a powerful firm prevent behavioral exploitation? And that takes us then through our third. And then our fourth, we're looking at competition and choice. And we love choices, right? It's just ingrained in us. And when is it that when competition will deliver too much choice? And there's a lot been written about choice overload. And what we then look at is how companies can manipulate choice overload for their advantage, not necessarily ours. So we come up then with these four scenarios by relaxing the assumptions and under what conditions competition could be toxic. And once you start looking at these four scenarios, you then realize that this is not a rare event, that you could look at competition around you, competition which you may participate in, that's actually toxic. So then that led us to part two of the book. So who's pushing this toxic competition? And we come up with four culprits. First are the ideologues. Second are the lobbyists. And we have some interesting stories there with the Trump administration. Third are the privatizers. And we'll touch a little bit on that today. And then the fourth, and probably the most sinister of the whole group, are the game makers. And these are the ones that can create the competitive process to ensure that they're always going to benefit. And so imagine, like Ariel pointed out, this rat race. We're all competing. And it doesn't matter who wins or loses, because the game maker, the one who designs the competitive process, design it in such a way that they will always benefit. And we'll look at some of today's game makers. Then the last part is, what are we going to do about it, right? So our editor said, you can't end with the game makers because that's just way too bleak. And it's too depressing. So is there hope? And actually there is. And so in the last part, we say, how can we reorient competition from that being toxic to that being noble? So our last two chapters, we first ask, what is competition? And rather than coming up with the single definition, we find that competition can exist along the spectrum. And then second, how do we go from one end of the spectrum to the other end? And we have some, and we all can play a role here, and we'll touch on that as well in this presentation. So now we're gonna say, all right, you've given out the 4, 4, and 2. I'm not really convinced. 50% of you think competition is always good. So now Ariel is gonna take, and most of you think beef is good. So that's a great lead in then for Ariel.
Okay, so what you see on the left is a beef lasagna, or at least we think it is. And that's the key here. So, I mean, in the book, we cover a lot of stories and we're trying to highlight the instances where competition just fails to deliver. But of course, for our presentation, we cherry picked some stories to give you a taste of what it is that we're discussing. And one of the stories is that of quality degradation. And in Europe, a few years back, we all woke up to the story that apparently when we were purchasing beef, when we were purchasing beef lasagnas, we were eating burgers, actually we were eating horse meat. And that is a very nice example. And there are many reasons for why this happened. Some to do with regulating the industry. But when you look behind them, what you realize that the engine behind this was intense competition. And let me explain. At the time, it was just after the economic downturn, what you had is a lot of pressure on price, and supermarkets in Europe were competing fiercely against each other. As they compete fiercely on price, because this is the main parameter that we as consumers focus on, they had to put pressure upwards on their suppliers. the suppliers of beef then put pressure on their suppliers, those that actually produce the beef in massive blocks. And this is where something really interesting happened. They were basically forced to lower the price they charge for the input because of that insane pressure. And
sí, estamos como que...
Yeah, we have someone who needs to mute their mic, please. So then what happened was that because of this intense pressure, they had an option, some of them. Either they go out of business or they start to cheat. And one of the parameters that again and again you can cheat on in competition because it's less visible is that of quality. So you see here an image of two boilers, and our assumption, most of us, is relatively simplistic. The competition boiler, if you want to get better results, increase the pressure within that boiler and you'll get exactly what you want, lower prices. And you assume that we as consumers, we will already identify the instances where quality is lowered. But the reality is that we often fail to identify quality degradation. And even more than that, we also have an assumption in our markets that if someone downgrades quality, another competitor will let you as the consumer know, because that will improve their position. But we fail to see that many times the other competitors are not exactly aware of the quality degradation, or maybe it is too costly for them to communicate it to you as consumer. Either way, what we had in this Horsegate scandal is many of us eating horse meat instead of beef. And here we went to speak with the people that actually worked at those factories. And we spoke with a person that also revealed this whole scandal. And he says very clearly, this is a byproduct of intense competition that happens in an environment which lacks certain regulatory instruments. So the lesson that you learned from the Horsegate scandal is that you can increase the pressure in the boiler, but when you do it, you need to send more and more engineers to monitor the boiler. Your assumption, our basic assumption that we actually often teach our students, that you can just increase the pressure and the competition machine is so magical that it is self-fulfilling and it will always deliver, is actually not true. And for those of you who are vegetarians and say, well, this does not affect me, let me give you an example from a completely different area. Look at the two horrible crashes that we had with the 737 MAX. Now, again, you can tell that story looking at the way they installed the program, the way they installed the engines. But part of the story goes back to intense competition and lack of safeguards. And you have a quote here for one of the engineers who basically said, what happened was Airbus was about to get a massive order for its own Neo airplanes. Boeing had to challenge that order. The only way to challenge it was for Boeing to offer larger 737s without additional training for pilots. The instruction then for the engineers was increase the 737, but whatever you do, do not make it in a way that requires additional training for pilots, because that's a deal breaker. And this is exactly what they've done. They created a program that was not revealed in the training to the pilots. The pilots actually did not know that the airplane and the programs were changed and modified. And this is why we had the crash. And now you would ask, so how can it be possible? Well, the Federal Aviation Administration, these are the engineers that should check the boiler. What happened is that over the years, they outsourced their inspection responsibilities to whom? To Boeing. So Boeing self-certified. And why is it that we say Boeing can self-certify? Because we assume that the competition machine is so powerful that Boeing will not have an incentive to downgrade quality, because this will harm Boeing. And what we see is that while this works in theory, in practice, the competition machine, when you overdose on it, it backfires. So this is one story. That's the story of the quality degradation. To give you a taste of something completely different, we'll go now to a story of the game makers, and Maurice will tell us a little bit more about that environment.
Sure. So the Game Makers is, we took it from the Hunger Games, and there you have the contestants from the different districts, and it really doesn't matter which contestant wins or loses, but you can engineer the game in such a way to keep the audience riveted. And it serves ultimately the elite in the capital, that they're the ones that benefit from the Hunger Games, regardless of which person ultimately prevails. And then we thought, well, you know, you look at The Amazing Race, Survivor, you could see how television producers can manipulate the competition in order to keep us watching, and then they'll primarily benefit as well. Then we thought, well, who are some of today's game makers? And we turn then to Google and Facebook, and we look at how they design the online advertising ecosystem. And you could say on one level, it looks robustly competitive because you have millions of publishers that are competing for ad revenue. You have millions of advertisers, on the other hand, that are competing to place their ads. And you have an auction process, and you have multiple auction processes at play. So in many ways, you could say this is the paradigm of competition. Yet, as the Senate hearings recently noted, they say if this is true, and if it's as robustly as competitive as Google and Facebook claim, the senators argued, why are we hearing so many complaints? And what you then find is that, first of all, this is not a transparent market. But once you start digging into the data, what you find then is that in designing the ecosystem, Google and Facebook can create an ecosystem that largely favors them and doesn't necessarily favor the publishers nor the advertisers. And if we go then to the next slide, what we can then see is there are various hooks that the game makers use. And one of them, I mean, the CMA came out in its July report. They said this is a competition for data and attention. So the first lever is the hook to obtain our attention. Then second is how to extract that data and to give it to the game maker. Because with these powerful platforms, those that have more personal data will have a competitive advantage. And then third, how to use this data to attract then bidders for personal advertising. And Senator Blumenthal, in last week's hearings, he noted that, first of all, Google and Facebook dominate digital advertising generally. Then even in the one sliver where there is this competition in the online intermediation ad tech stack, where it is advertisers looking to advertise display ads somewhere other than Facebook and Google, that Google dominates that ad tech stack as well. And as he noted, that in no other market is there one entity that represents most of the buyers, most of the sellers, controls the exchange, and also sets the rules of the game. So what you then see is that the interests of the game makers are not necessarily aligned with our interests. And even though there's competition, it's not competition that necessarily is working to the benefit of publishers who are complaining, not necessarily working to the benefit of advertisers who complain about the lack of transparency. Certainly not benefiting us in terms of the way that our data is being harvested, not for us, but basically to use it in order to addict us and to get us to buy things that we might not otherwise buy at the highest price that we can possibly pay. So that then takes us to, all right, so the game makers, certainly under attack. The Texas State Attorney General's office is likely to bring a case that will focus on Google's dominance in the ad tech stack. But then who else is then pushing this toxic competition? So who else, Ariel?
Okay, so another story that we want to share with you has to do with the idea of privatization. Now, this is a massive area, and to begin with, no doubt, many times competitive markets, free markets work much better than the government. So we don't have any issue with the idea of privatization. Of course, most of what we see around us works much better because it is not controlled by the state. So what we're telling you now is a story that is a bit more nuanced. It is about the idea of people using the concept of competition in order to justify power, in order to move resources from the state to themselves, even when it is clear that competition doesn't work. And a good example of that, quite a visible one, is private prisons in the US. As some of you may know, at the end of the Obama administration, there was a plan actually to close at the federal level the use of private prisons because of all the complaints that were there. And yet, this has completely changed with the Trump administration. So we have this little quiz that basically helps illustrate the issues here. If you assume that competition delivers a better result than private operated services, which is often the case, then ask yourself, do private prisons provide better correctional services, programs, and security? Do they do much better work when it comes to rehabilitation? And do they have the interest that we have, which is basically to promote a society that works? And the answer, which is quite obvious, is no, no, no. None of these statements are true. The reality is that some markets don't work well when you privatize them, which in other words is to say that in some instances, the concept of competition doesn't really deliver when you have other societal values. And you have stories about private prisons bribing judges to increase the periods that young offenders have to spend in jail, or stories about private prisons punishing for any violation with an increase of the period that you have to spend in jail, because every day someone spends in jail is more time. Private prisons not actually investing in rehabilitation because they have no interest in doing so. And of course, providing the lowest quality of services, food, and in some cases, not even enough security to manage the facility. There are stories of inmates basically walking out because there is no one there to even safeguard the facility. And some facilities become extremely violent. They're known as gladiators schools. So the story of the private prisons is a story of how today, many times, if you go as a policymaker and you throw around the concept of competition, it is very hard to object to it. It's almost a magical lever that you can use. And we have that in the UK. There is an interesting example of we privatized the water supply here in England because competition was regarded as something that will deliver us better choices. At the end of this very long story, the private companies took a loan of around 70 billion and they divided dividends at the same amount. And what you have now is a result where we pay in England much higher fees for water supply than you do in Scotland, where it's still managed by the state. Again, this doesn't mean that privatization doesn't always work. But what it means is that many times now you see how lobbyists and interested parties are pushing to the idea of privatization, even though those are markets that are just not suitable. And Maurice, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the origins then.
So, right. So one of the nice things about writing a book is you can go on these little detours. And we were then wondering, well, who actually coined the term privatization? And our original thought was it had to be either Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan. And it turns out that it actually predated them. It came from the Nazis. So Maxine Sweezy, who was getting her PhD at Cambridge at that time, looked at the Nazi economy. And what she found was that Hitler used privatization. It was called Reprivatisierung. Basically to enlist the economic elite. So they went then to the powerful companies at that time And they promised then to divest some of the state assets and give it to them in exchange for their support of their administration. And what I thought was interesting is that when we think about privatization currently, it's often sort of, well, we're going to provide a state asset for the benefit of many. When the origin of the term is that privatization was to benefit the few at the expense of many. And we can see at times how privatization might actually support many of us, but we can also see how the state can use privatization and those that know that privatization will not work to primarily benefit at our expense. So where does that then take us then, Ariel?
So then we started to think of, as Maurice indicated at the start, what is it that we can do about it? And what we thought is helpful is to create a spectrum so we all better understand the types of competition that we see on different markets. And rather than have this idea that competition is always the same, it's a process of rivalry, identify instances where you have toxic competition, where everyone suffers, where those who compete suffer, society suffers, there is no benefit, zero-sum competition, which many times happens, and sometimes it's the only type of competition that you can have when you have limited resources. Positive-sum competition, which is something where you can have a competition that also advances some sort of an ethical value. It's the kind of competition that probably all of us imagine. And then we also came up with the idea of noble competition. And noble competition is there just as when you think about a basic economic analysis, when you have the model of perfect competition and you have it there, and you know that there aren't any markets that necessarily have perfect competition. But by understanding the model of perfect competition, it really helps you understand the spectrum and what it is that you're aiming toward. And for us, noble competition, in many ways, this is the type of competition that if you were the game maker, if you are the government, this is the type of dynamic that you want to see. And Maurice will take us a little bit in more detail into this concept of noble competition.
Right. So what's noble competition? And noble competition, as we define it, is competition that helps your rivals achieve their fullest. Now, think about that. Helping your rivals achieve their best. So when we originally were, and there was a lecture at Oxford that inspired us with that. But when we mentioned it to some of our friends and colleagues, they came up then with the lysine example. And if you recall from that case, ADM, one of their chief executives, their top executive said, our competitors are our friends. The customer is our enemy. So if you're defining noble competition as helping their rivals fulfill their fullest, aren't you really then just condoning the cartels, the ADM cartel? And that was our struggle because we said, how do we, obviously that's not our purpose. That's not noble competition. And as Ariel pointed out, when we got to the game makers chapter, that really then helped us because we thought if the government were to then pick and choose among the different types of competition, how would they then structure it? And it would probably be structured the way that we would encourage it if our children compete. So, you know, both Ariel and I have children. They compete against one another. And we obviously wouldn't want our children to engage in toxic competition against one another. If they're playing tennis, you certainly don't want one child to hit the other child over the head with a tennis racket. Nor do you want to perceive it as zero-sum competition. But what you would want is a mutual striving of excellence, that each child then pushes the other child and that both of them reach then their full potential. And that's the same way that from a societal standpoint, what we want competition. And in answering the question, how you rank the different forms of competition, we use two questions. First, to what extent does competition actually serve us rather than our serving it? And then second, to what extent does the competition bring out our best rather than our worst? So from the game maker's perspective, we can then reorient certainly away from the toxic competition that we can eliminate. At times we'll have then the zero sum, but that shouldn't be the default. And we should really move towards positive sum competition and noble competition. So how can we do so? And we here see that everyone has a role to play. So first, the government has a role to play. And one role is to put guardrails to prevent competition from turning toxic. This involves what, you know, the safety violations, not only involving Boeing, but also the food processors in Europe. But we can also then expand that to the environment and also human work, human and slave labor and improving worker conditions. But there's also, sometimes we're asked, well, isn't it really just a function of the regulations that you don't have the right guardrails? If you have the right guardrails, competition will always deliver. And our second key message that we point out is that even if you have the right guardrails, there's some things that competition cannot provide, that the government has an important role to play, including providing a safety net, the freedom from want that FDR mentioned. So then we go then to the next area is, well, what can companies do? And one of them is looking beyond shareholder maximization. That's become increasingly popular with the Business Roundtable and the like. But then the second thing is really a chilling tale of what happens when companies unleash competition internally. You might think, oh, competition is so great. Why don't we start having employees compete against one another? Why don't we have divisions compete against one another? And we have actually an interesting story of a company that did that, was actually praised for being one of the top companies to work for, and ended up with its senior executives in jail and the company having the largest bankruptcy in history. And then looking beyond the companies, then it turns to us. And what can we do? And here, what we point out is we go back to Stanley Milgram, if you really interesting social scientist. And if you recall, he did these studies to see to what extent would a human being actually administer an electric shock to someone else. And it was he was looking at obedience and to what extent under situational factors, can we end up doing things that are just basically evil? And one of the key lessons that came from Milgram's experiments was the power of dissent. That if one of the administrators dissented, that had a very powerful impact. But also when there were forms of the experiment where there were two or more individuals that were administering it, when one of them dissented, that too can have a powerful impact. So one area that we point out is the power of dissent. And then the second is the power of our purchases. And we bring up the farmers market. This is a photo of the one here in Knoxville. How we ourselves can play an important role in reorienting out of this toxic competition to something nobler. And that could be not only what we purchase, but also for academics. I mean, it's just amazing how Ariel and I kind of say, yeah, I'm not going to get embroiled in that toxic competition. I mean, we see it every day that there's this sort of status competition that can be toxic. And you can then make a decision. Do I really want to contribute to that? Or do I want to then opt for something nobler? And I think we can.
Yep. So I think we can probably end with that. We also had, after the book came out, we've done some work on COVID-19 and overdose, which was really interesting. So maybe if I'll just mention it briefly, that it's actually quite astonishing, because you see the whole spectrum of different types of competition through this social experiment that we're all taking part in. So from toxic competition that you see at the beginning for ventilators and states that could have been resolved relatively easily if you know, if, for example, in the US, the federal government would have stepped in instead of the different states competing against each other through zero-sum competition. And then we even had instances of noble competition in the collaboration, sharing of information that usually will not happen among scientists. So with the spectrum that we create, it's quite helpful because sometimes you look around you and immediately you get a sense, is competition serving me or am I serving competition? And the outcome is completely different depending on where you are on that spectrum.
Thank you very much for the presentation. The last part regarding the COVID-19 and showing the whole spectrum that you established in your book is very interesting on the novel competition side, on sharing some information between researchers and things. So that's something that maybe we can expand a little on the Q&A, maybe. Now, Anne-Lynn, please, if you can go ahead with your comments on this book. Thank you.
Thank you. Before I start, I think I need to give full disclosure. I'm European, and that means that by American standards, I am probably considered a socialist, irrespective of where I fall on the European political spectrum. And I'm making this disclosure because as a result of my growing up in continental Europe, enjoying free healthcare, free education, and virtually free public transport, I was actually surprised to see how much of a ripple Ariel and Maurice's book has caused. I very much enjoyed it, and I think the timing of the book could not be more appropriate because it looks like 2020 desperately needs a reminder of why too much competition can be a bad thing. And so I wanted to take just a couple of minutes to share the four big things that I took away from the book. And I think the first one for me was that not every part of our life needs to be a market. I think the book offers plenty of examples of things in our lives that have become driven by profit maximizing market rationale. You have college education and sports, there's aircraft and safety, other forms of transportation, personal data, prisons and rehabilitation, water supply. And I wholeheartedly agree with the authors that sometimes competition overdose leads to a negative outcome in those markets. But I would even take it further. And I would say, should we even look at these things as markets in the first place? So is the question of competition not secondary? And isn't the first question, should we even think of these things as markets? Because if you think about it, is our entire life marketable? Should healthcare or education even be a product, or are these things rights? And what about information, personal data, our attention span? It feels like everything can be mined and monetized like gold these days, whereas I would say at least some of these things are rights. And then when you take that further, what about unleashing a growth rationale on things that we do not necessarily want to grow? And I think Ariel and Maurice touched upon this. Prison populations or hospital populations, I don't think there's anyone who would argue that we need those populations to grow. And so that begs the question, obviously, who should decide what is a market, what is a product, and what can or cannot be monetized? And that brings me to the second takeaway from the book, and that is that policymakers really need to up their game. I think in principle, democratically elected lawmakers are the ones to decide what is a right, what is a product, and how markets should be regulated, if at all. But in order to do that effectively, we need to make sure that lawmakers are equipped to tackle complex markets, to understand how they work, what incentives are at play, and what likely outcomes of regulatory interventions will be. And I think Ariel or Maurice, you touched upon it too. Anyone who has listened to the congressional hearings on Facebook will realize that not all lawmakers understand these things. They don't understand tech markets. They don't understand the complexity of ad revenue-driven businesses relying on user-generated content. They may not even have a Facebook profile to start with. So if you look at the gap that exists between the competencies that for example, big tech has compared to what our lawmakers have, you really wonder, you know, where are the neurologists, the behavioral scientists, the data scientists, even basic marketeers among our lawmakers? They are just not there. And so how can we expect them to be equipped to understand these markets themselves, to regulate these markets or to define them as markets if they don't have these competencies? And the problem that you then have is, if they don't have these competencies, who are they listening to? Where do they take their advice from? And that you open the, you basically open the door to lobbyists. And I think I'm not against lobbying per se, because obviously there are ways for industry to convey or to give more information to lawmakers. I think the problem is, if that is the only source of information, it becomes impossible for lawmakers to see what is now right, who has which incentives, and why are they saying these things to me. I also don't necessarily view the revolving door as evil per se, because I think in principle, the revolving door can mean that competencies flow across industry to policy to academia. And I think that's a very healthy, you know, exchange of viewpoints. But I think that the revolving door needs some sort of a batch system, I would call it, such as, you know, decent conflict of interest clearances, ensuring that the right incentives are in place to ensure that people work for their current job and not for their next job. If all of that works, I think filling the competency gap through the revolving door, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Can you guys still hear me? Because it looks like my Zoom froze.
We can see you and we can hear you.
Yeah. Okay, good. And then I like the challenge. I'm actually very happy that you didn't end the book with the game makers part, because it's pretty bleak. And I saw the last part on the role of companies and what role can companies play to create an environment for noble competition. I really liked it, and it resonated with me, because having dealt with compliance in a big international company myself, I can totally see how some of the very concrete steps that the book offer, if you put them in practice and if you really think through, how can you make sure that people do what they actually probably would do if it weren't for an organization? So how do you maintain the incentives of people to do the right thing? It's super powerful. So some of the things that I noted down that we try to implement in our global compliance program is, one, you know, no box ticking, right? So ethics and compliance should be more than a set of procedures that people can mindlessly comply with. So I think anyone who has seen code of business conduct questionnaires flying around at the end of the year, where people just have to tick a box where they say, yes, I've complied with everything, all the rules, and they just tick and send it back to compliance as a means of sort of a control over compliance. Obviously that doesn't work. So we change that to making sure that people actually learn how to exercise good judgment in concrete scenarios. So we built a sort of, I always call it like a video game, where people start and then they have to pick scenarios, and it takes them to the next situation, and then people decide what to do. I think the point about having very clear accountability, and so no diffused accountability, is a super important one, especially in hierarchical organizations. So what we always make clear to our people is that everyone is accountable for acting ethically, and it's also actually enshrined in people's compensation. So, you know, because my boss told me so, it's for us never an excuse. You know, at best, then we go after the boss as well. The slippery slope point, and that's the point that if you don't go after the small stuff, or if you leave the small infringements unaddressed, it is very likely that you'll end up with larger infringements on your hands. So we also devote time and resources to just going after smaller infringements. Obviously, the punishment is proportionate to the infringement, but just not letting smaller things slip, I think, is super important in an organization to make sure that people understand that, you know, if there is an ethical rule, we will not tolerate even the smallest infraction. And then the point about dissent and making sure that people have ways to dissent or to speak up when they see that something is not going right is a critical part. It's how do you ensure as an organization that when people feel like they have to do something or they are getting instructions or they feel that there's an overarching narrative to compete in a toxic way, how do you make sure that they speak up? And how do you provide ways and venues and hotlines and other processes that they can use and rely on to offer their dissent? I think that's probably the most difficult thing to do, because people, and there's a cultural component there too, but people don't like to be snitches. But I think it's very important to educate employees on the fact that a good natured dissent is not snitching. And then my fourth and final takeaway from the book, and this is going to be one for the people that have actually read it, is that don't go to Vegas if you don't have to. And if you have to, don't book the Trump Hotel.
Thanks, Anne-Lynn. That's good advice, and that's a good chapter on the book also referring to that. We can go for questions on the audience. I just want to make a quick comment. Seems like we have to do a double check regarding what is happening in the market. Sometimes we can have this competition process distorted by what we know in antitrust law, abuse of dominance or other things. And sometimes it's the competition process that has made this toxic competition scenarios. And maybe you can then explain for all the panelists how you distinguish one and another. Because sometimes, as Anne-Lynn said, and you prove on your book, it's difficult for the same members of the market to get away of that toxic competition. Sometimes even they are not easily, they cannot move from that market or stay away of the type of conduct you described once there. So now, Pablo, we can give the video and the voice to Juan David Gutierrez from Colombia. He had a question.
Thank you, Nicolas. Yes, and thank you very much, Ariel and Noris, for your presentation. Unfortunately, I haven't read your book, But I totally sympathize with the idea that competition is not always the best tool to solve problems. But I do want to press you with one of the examples that you mentioned, and it's the airlines examples. So simply by coincidence, I've been reading lately about deregulation in the airline industry in the US. I'm reading this book from Biscusi et al. And one of the issues that they deal with is about safety in the airline industry and whether the 1970s deregulation that promoted price competition and more players and more flights had any negative impact on safety. And then there's this graph, which I'm not sure everyone's watching, but that shows how there's a general trend towards greater safety if you measure it in terms of the number of deaths, the number of fatal accidents, in fact, which shows that in general, the airline industry is not less safe now after the increase in competition. The book that you presented, and I would like to read, and this data from Biscusi and his associates make me think is whether the case of the specific airline that you studied can actually be extrapolated to other cases, whether in the jargon of the social sciences, whether there's external validity for that case study. But more largely, I have a question regarding how much does competition contribute to the result, in the sense that we have this horrible case from the airline that you mentioned, but many things didn't work. It was not just about cutthroat competition. It seems that other things, both at the level of the companies and the state level, were not working. So how much was it about the level of competition and how much was about other types of failures? But again, thank you very much.
It's an excellent question. And so I'll start, and I'm sure then Maurice will have some additional elements that he would add. So first of all, I think what you see when you look at that graph is that we often confuse more competition with better technology. So the main reason that we don't have accidents is that our airplanes are much safer. Why are they safer? Because competition helped. So again, this is not about saying that competition is bad. The competition between Airbus and Boeing, the competition in smaller manufacturers between other providers is the engine that creates innovation. It is the engine that creates exactly all the benefits that we get. Okay, then why is it working? As long as you had sufficient level of regulatory provisions that safeguards that, then it worked. And here is the balancing exercise. So my first comment is that the improvement is not necessarily, you know, is it causation, correlation? What you see is that with the reduction of some regulatory instruments, there has been an increase in safety, but it's not the result of that. It might be also the result of that, but it's mostly because of technology. The important thing here to appreciate is that if you trust competition to the extent that you truly believe that this is what drives everything to work much better, then there's no room for the state intervention anywhere. And a good example, if you want to take it from the airline industry, will be look at banks. Banks always argue, let us sell all products, remove all the regulatory instruments. And you saw what happens. And the idea is, and the reason I mentioned that, because it is a notion that goes beyond the anecdote and beyond the specific market. Yes, you increase competition, that's great. But at some point, when you increase competition and you are not careful to put safeguards in place, what you'll have is then competition that goes against our interest. So the balance that you have to exercise is between government failure, because governments are often not efficient, they often get it wrong, and between market failure, competition failure. And it's somewhere in between that you want to be. You want to get all the benefits of competition without letting it turn toxic. And this is the message of the book. Maurice, you might want to add on.
Yeah, I would just say that one of the earlier articles that Ariel and I pointed out that's relevant in the digital economy is how companies can compete based on quality. And so we don't dispute that increasing competition at times can actually improve quality. But what we do argue is that there, in order for that competition to improve quality, there are at least four assumptions that have to be satisfied. And once you relax those four assumptions, then you can have an increase in competition with not an increase in quality, but actually a deterioration in quality. And the way to view it is this boiler, that if you increase the competitive pressure and you want to hold price then constant or lower it, something ultimately will give. And now if you have a strong regulatory framework that can protect it, but if you assume that the boiler is self-regulating, then you will then see. And then to go like with deregulation, there is some work that deregulation in the trucking industry, you had vigorous competition, but you also had then trucks that weren't safe on the road. And the government had to intervene in order to limit that. So we're not questioning that increase in competition can increase quality. What we are challenging is that it's self-regulating.
Okay. We have Fernando Araya, who has a question.
Hello, many thanks for the presentation. And I would like to ask Maurice to try to build a link between its former scholarship on the rule of law in competition law and how this broader perception of distinguishing between a noble competition and an unnoble competition will conjugate with the rule of law.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, when Ariel launched the Journal of Antitrust Enforcement, it was for that first edition that I did, Is Competition Always Good? And Bill Kovacic, who was the head of the FTC, was the chair, and all of you know Bill. I mean, he had a really interesting question about that. He said, well, who should make that determination? If competition is not always good, who should make that determination? Should it be the courts? Should they create an exception? Should it be Congress? Should it be the agencies? And how do you do it in a way then that complies with the rule of law? So currently the Supreme Court has taken off the table the notion that competition at times could be ruinous. And so it's not a defense, they won't entertain it. And you could say that that complies then with the rule of law, right? Because now you know that companies can't argue it, they can't manipulate it. And you can then have objective, predictable response. The problem though with the rule of law is you're not gonna get necessarily an accurate response, that you're going to then, the court is going to at times support toxic competition. So then the issue is, should it be the courts that create the exception or should it be the legislature? And I think looking at the Aniline, her 4 points, her second point was really, I thought, on target here is, I think there's going to be then, first of all, the lawmakers need to be attuned to this. Second, they can't rely just on the lobbyists. They need to engage with multiple stakeholders. And that third, whatever standard that they then employ would have to then comport with rule of law standards, because then otherwise you could see then it would just be another system that could be gamed, right? That cartel members are saying ruinous competition. And, you know, Ariel and I, we had this discussion about chickens from our good friend who's an economist in the Netherlands. He brought that example to us. So you do need to then have, I believe, lawmakers propose standards in a way that would comport with the rule of law, and that might then carve out these instances where competition could be toxic and then come up with alternatives. But Ariel, you might have, from a European perspective, some additional insights.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, of course, I agree. And I mean, if I can add maybe an additional perspective that can be interesting to some of you, when Maurice and I, when we developed the book, we met with quite a lot of competition enforcers, and you can, the ideas in the book, you can run them at two levels. One is just focus on the process of competition, and two is focus on how competition law actually works and what part of the process of competition impacts on the way we apply competition law. So there are two parallel dimensions where this discussion of the benefits of competition takes place. And in our presentation now, we focus mostly on the part of the dynamic. Is the dynamic beneficial? And your question takes us a little bit more to the other dimension, where you ask, okay, if the dynamic isn't always perfect, how do I reflect that through the law? What is it that I do? when it comes to applying competition law. And one of the comments, I think, and first of all, the amazing thing was that the economists that we spoke with the, from the enforcers, they were all on board. And what they all said is, yeah, for us, it's very clear. Competition can really backfire. The problem is with the legislator. The legislator needs to make a decision as to what exactly do they want to get out of it. So competition can sometimes backfire and not deliver the benefits that we want. We gave you examples. But even when competition works perfectly, it might not deliver the results that you would like as a society. So there is some sort of a policy call that needs to be made. What is it that we, and I say we loosely because we in Europe might be different than we in the US or we in Canada or Australia or Latin America, different we, what do you want out of your markets? And some jurisdictions will say, well, actually I value a little bit of inefficiency because I have other values that I want to promote. And some jurisdictions will say, no, what I want is efficiency. I elevate efficiency as the value. And then it takes us into a debate, which I find extremely fascinating, of what competition law is about. And we often in the antitrust community, we tend to discuss it as if there is one truth, one answer that will just present itself. And there isn't. The reality is that different jurisdictions, different countries will have a completely different idea on the role competition law ought to play and how to regulate that competition. And we sometimes find it very odd that you will have certain goals for competition. You have countries that promote equality as part of competition, others that promote fairness, others that promote efficiency, others that promote consumer welfare, and some have all of them together, but they will have different prioritization. And all of it actually links to your trust in the market and your belief that markets should rule or markets should rule alongside some sort of indication from the government. So I hope that adds another dimension to what Maurice said.
That's, yes, actually that's because then we have the goals, we have other things that get into this mixture. Now we have a question by the chat. I have to tell you that Manuel is a colleague of mine, so there's no preference in here. He just sent the question by the chat. And so Manuel Abarca, if you want to do your question, please.
Thank you very much, Nicolas. Congratulations to Maurice and Ariel. Personally, I'm a big fan of Maurice's work, and particularly his previous book on big data is one of my favorite books, and I think it would be an antitrust classic on the next years. This is a question very related to the previous question by Fernando. In many Latin American countries, the competition policies are only run mostly by antitrust or competition authorities, mostly by advocacy more than enforcement. However, other agencies that are necessary in order to achieve all these problems regarding toxic competition, for example, consumer protection authorities, regulatory agencies in general, are not much aware of competition topics. Even we have situations where provisions by one agency is a totally contradiction of provisions by the competition authorities. In this sense, in situations where we don't have or a legislative or an agency's competition policies, are the antitrust authorities in best positions to address these topics? Thank you very much.
Maurice, you're on mute.
Do you want me to take the lead on this one? Okay, I would just say, in order to be effective advocates of competition, that the government authority would first have to recognize what competition, even in its noblest form, can or can't deliver. So that's number one. So I think in order for effective advocacy, a competition authority has to recognize when can competition provide a service or good, when it can't. And there, you know, increasingly in the United States now, there's this discussion of having a public option, that rather than just relying on the market forces won't necessarily always deliver. And this is something not controversial in the founding of the United States when they decided to have a post office, because they realized that market forces will not necessarily distribute the mail to all regions of the United States, and that in order to have an informed electorate, they needed access to publications, they needed to have mail. And so mail, there was like a public right to mail. So there was a public option for having mail offices. So I would say the first is the competition authority would have to recognize what competition can or can't deliver. And then second, I think there's a need for a more nuanced outlook on the different forms of competition, and that you won't magically have, let's say, a form of competition that's more oriented towards noble. So there is going to be a requirement to develop the scaffolding to ensure that the, you know, the regulations are in place to reorient competition away from toxic to something noble. And then third is, I think the competition authority has to then have a recognition that increasing competition when competition already is toxic can only make things worse. And I'm thinking, you know, you're seeing this blind spot now in some of the reports by the agencies that are pushing in the digital economy that, oh, we just need more competition. We need to give rivals greater access to that data. And once they have access to that data, we're gonna be better off. And as Eneline pointed out, that when it comes to attention and big data, if the current competition is toxic and giving companies more access to that data will not necessarily benefit us, it's actually going to then lead to a surveillance economy that can actually make us worse off, that the competition officials have to recognize that, wait a second, are what we're trying to promote the toxic competition? And if we just unleash more of it, it's not going to magically transform into something better.
Thank you very much for the answers. We are arriving to our time, so I think Pablo will send the poll again. In the meantime, when you answer, what's your preferred kind of meet. I want to invite everybody to the next event of the IDC with the Mexican chapter on October the 7th and be part of the of this thing that we are doing here. And I wanted just to give a thank you to Professor Serraji, Professor Estaki, and to Annaline for their kind presentation and for believing in our program as we are studying. And also to thank other people that has been acting through the IDC. I see Barry Hogg, that he presented his book earlier. So thank you very much. So now, if you can answer the poll, I'm very intrigued. What's the answer on question number four?
We can get some more answers, that would help. We have some already. You tell me, Nico, when I finish.
We have a few more minutes, so let's see the answers.
There you have them.
So it's a it has to be redefined, the consumer welfare standard. Okay, is competition always good? No, 75%, and don't know on a 78. That was in 0% before. Competition benefits consumer always? False, 100%, okay. And what's your favorite meat? They stick with beef, but all there's a little change in there, and we have a 25% of people that is not sure what's their favorite meat. So
I think with the fourth one is probably the way to read it is that your favorite meat is beef, or at least what you believe to be beef.
Yes, I think that the correct answer is not sure in any aspects. But with that, I want to thank you all and for being here. And we're looking forward to see you in another event. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.